The Conversation Hour with John Fain on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
My co-host today is Gail Jennings. Dr. Gail Jennings is the CEO of Great Connections, the not-for-profit group, which she'll remind us about in just a moment. Former ABC science journalist and presenter here on 774 ABC Melbourne. Gail, good to see you again.
Good to see you, John.
For people who are catching up on Great Connections, what do you do?
Well, it's this fantastic not-for-profit which links executives and professionals who are reaching retirement age or actually are just 55-plus mature age and recruits them as volunteers to provide free business and other executive volunteering work into a whole range of not-for-profits where they do really quite fun, you know, strong consultancy work, if you like. They actually do bodies of work. They don't just do little bits and pieces and a little. They are project managed by our client managers who are also volunteers. And so it's a sort of a personalised service whereby you're being assisted to become viable and sustainable if you're a not-for-profit.
Give me some anecdotes, some examples of. Are you allowed to?
Yes. Like, so the Reichstein Foundation, which is a foundation that's sort of looking to create justice and equity and to help people in a whole variety of need. For example, one of our volunteers created the archive library and runs it. So that's a volunteer that's ongoing. She's a very experienced librarian. Another one did the web page and carries that on. And one of our consultants for a very large, as I say, this is pro bono work, the volunteers, for a very large not-for-profit, whose name I won't mention, did a national organisational restructure of all the offices. It was about $100,000 worth of work, and they did that for nothing. So we do a lot of, we probably did about $2 million worth of free work last year and the year before $1 million. And so we're hoping to obviously expand and grow. And we've just had fabulous news in the last couple of weeks. We've had three grants come through, one of them a major one from a fantastic philanthropic organisation that wants to remain anonymous. But that will enable us to expand. Some of that money is actually from the Harold Mitchell Foundation. And that's to expand into the arts not-for-profit sector so that we can use our volunteers to assist all sorts of arts not-for-profits. But the major grant is more operational to enable us to just expand our services to more and more not-for-profits because overall we're impacting on hundreds of thousands of people who are in some kind of need, whether they're homeless or youth at risk or they've got a disability or a chronic illness.
So it's about spending a little bit of money to make a big difference.
Yeah, it's about a 20-fold amplification
leveraging volunteers.
Dollar. Yes, that's right.
And then the impact is felt out in the community.
And I should say we are actually looking now, we're expanding, we're looking for more volunteers. So if you're a professional person who's 55 plus and you want to do some meaningful work and meet new friends because it is moderated, you know, by its personalised relationship. You know, do call our office.
Sorry, what do you mean meet new friends? It's not a dating agency you're running here, is it?
Well, actually, funnily enough, somebody has brought that up. They said, this is excellent. This is a mature age dating agency. Well, no, that was not what I was meaning, although if that happens, that's excellent.
Great connections.
Yes, they're clever. We could have a sideline. There's a social enterprise. No, but we do have lots of functions. But you also, what I'm meaning is it's intergenerational relationships because you get to work in a not-for-profit with a whole lot of people you wouldn't have met otherwise who are smart and capable but need your acumen.
But there's also that thing that, I don't know how many times I've heard this recently, people who have left work and then after 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, different people at different points say, oh, I'm kind of missing it.
Oh, absolutely.
And I want to stay active, I want to stay involved, and I mean, there's only so much golf I can play or so much fishing I can do, and I wish I had more to do, and I wish I was back in kind of not at the same stress levels, but back being useful.
And also, it is how you gain a lot of your identity, and it's where you get a lot of satisfaction. And in fact, the major sponsor of Great Connections from the beginning all the way through until now and still a sponsor is Australian Unity, which is just the insurance company. And they also do a lot of research into the impact of retirement. And the research that they have done shows, or through the Australian Centre for Health Research, whom they fund, who's in our building, they have shown that the impact on retirees or older people doing volunteer work is huge. There's a huge well-being impact. So it's actually doing really good work
for your own physical and mental well-being.
Plus you're linking with really, you know, you're doing an amazing lot of good work yourself.
I read in the paper today, one of the newspapers, that the men's shed networks are running out of money. And there's a classic example in particular.
Well, don't tell our donors.
Well, in particular, in regional Australia, the men's shed movement has just been fantastic.
It's a really good thing to do.
Does really good things.
Although I would say in the regions too. You see, this is where we're hoping to expand, because there are a whole lot of mature age people there who are looking for something to do.
Well, changes, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So there are lots of not for profits out there too. We want to link people regionally. So
the whole country had grown to a stop if people stopped volunteering,
and
if we resource them better and link them in better, the benefits are enormous.
Oh, it's something like, I think it's, I should have this figure, it's billions and billions of dollars. It's more than all the public funds from all lots of governments are actually, that's the amount of money that the value of the work that volunteers do in Australia. So we would absolutely fall over. And we're talking about not just the little footy club for your kids, but all the way through to the major ones that are looking at our children who are at risk. Or...
But every hospital, every health service, every disability organisation, kindergarten, schools, you can go right across, look at the work done by volunteers in prisons, look at every aspect of the whole of society. It's extraordinary what people do.
And they literally don't have funds, and they don't have funds now because of the GFC, and they also... very often, those not-for-profits, those small not-for-profits, will start up with somebody who's either a local or someone they know has got that disease or whatever, and they don't have the business acumen. They don't know how to do a strategic plan or a business plan, how to get funds, how to, run a business. And so that's why there's such a huge call on our services. And it's just quite inspirational being involved with it. I love it. Now, our webpage
For people who are wondering,
because I really am hoping that we'll have a rush of wonderful volunteers and also a rush of not-for-profits who are looking for assistance, is www.greatconnections, which is all one word, .com.au.
Greatconnections.com.au. Gail, anything new in the world of science before we invite our first guest, who's just got off a plane from Burma, from Myanmar, as I think we're supposed to call it now?
That's right. Yes, it is. And yes, he's absolutely wonderful. He's the head of... Well, anyway, we're doing that in a minute, but he's the head of the Burnett Institute. Yes, look, I was just having just reading on the weekend. In fact, I read a lot on the weekend. I had one of those wonderful weekends where you can read. But I was fascinated to read that it's now scientifically proven that human beings are evolving much faster than they ever have before, that we've evolved more in the last 5,000 years than we had in any time before that, right back to when we co-resided with Neanderthals 30,000 years ago. Isn't that interesting?
So
we've got 100 times the rate of evolution in the last 5 years as compared with before that.
Why would that be?
Well, I think it's because of population growth. We used to have just a few million people way back then, and now there's 6.5 billion. And they think that with the density of population, well, the sheer numbers, right? So the sheer numbers is obviously going to ramp it up. But also it's actually the mutations that are being adapted for are things like disease resistance, cute things like dry earwax, a gene for having dry earwax in Asian populations. I'm not sure why that is terrific to have.
Now a gene that's evolved.
Yes.
To do with earwax.
To do with earwax, yes, if that's right. And there's another
one. So someone is spending their entire scientific life dedicated to the study of earwax.
No, well, they're not actually going to ears with little cotton buds. In fact, there are these two big projects, actually. You will have heard of one. One's the Genographic Project, which is IBM and National Geographic, which is going around and getting everyone to send in samples of their DNAs from taking a swab from their cheeks, and then they just sequence all their DNA. But this one has been going, I think, longer, and it's called the International HapMap Project, where it's that short for what's called haplotype mapping. It's the same thing. You take genes, you have genes from a whole lot of different people, you sequence all their genes, so you lay them all out as a map. You look at every single molecule, and you compare them across people across the world, and you compare them with whatever DNA you've got from Neanderthals, which they do have, and so on. And so by doing that, they're able to see what tiny variations there are. There are more variations now between people from different parts of the world than there used to be between people and Neanderthals. Not between people and Neanderthals, than there have been over time.
Right.
So they're just basically comparing strings of beads.
And different people in different parts of the globe today are evolving in different ways.
Yes. Interestingly, as you know, we all sort of came from Africa. We were all in Europe. We co-resided with the Neanderthals. But people about 10,000 years ago were sort of fairly much isolated and very, sort of isolated, not very isolated, in various parts of Europe and the world. But they, And that's where in those groups, those mutations were adapted very quickly. So there are things like the ability to digest milk as an adult in Europeans. That's an evolution that's been done very quickly. There's resistance to certain epidemic diseases in other groups that, you know, have been really pushed to the brink. So the people who are resistant to have survived. It's fascinating. So we always used to say, were we evolving quicker? And we are.
Gail Jennings from Great Connections. Recruiting for volunteers and also people who might be organisational representatives looking for assistance from volunteers. greatconnections.com.au if you want to get in touch with them. Our first guest joining us in just a moment has got off the plane from Myanmar, from Burma. And after the cyclone in, a bit more than a year ago, he's been looking at health issues in a country that usually does not make people welcome. And he will join us as our first guest in just a moment.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Gail Jennings from Great Connections is my co-host. And our first guest has just got off the plane from Burma, or Myanmar, as the military regime to prefer to call it. Professor Brendan Crabb is the director of the Burnet Institute, and he's been there to try to help people. Brendan, welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Thank you, John.
How long were you there for?
I was there just for a week, which people keep telling me is a very short amount of time. For me, I thought it was a long time, but just for a week, which was, you know, a good opportunity to get a sense, at least. Nothing comprehensive, but a sense of the issues that Burma faces and of the work that our organisation does there.
It's impossible to talk about Burma or Myanmar without discussing the current human rights situation there and the fact that it's a military dictatorship of a quite repressive kind. So are you doing the right thing by going, or the wrong thing? Are you giving support to a government that's illegitimate? And let's deal with all of those things right up the front.
Well, it's obviously very, very tricky territory and something we give a lot of thought to. We're not expert in. But I guess the criteria for us is whether the humanitarian need is sufficient for us to get involved, even given those circumstances, and whether the money that we spend or the Australian government spends through us can be wisely and effectively spent in our way, which is to build the capacity of Burmese people and of their civil societies to sustainably improve health in the country. If we think those things can be done, whether it be in Myanmar or any other place, we'll get involved. So, but it is very tricky territory.
Did you offer? How did it work?
They have a centre there, don't you? You've already established there with AusAid money, is that right?
We do indeed. We've been there since 2003 with an office. We've been involved in the country longer than that. And we are there on AusAid funding and other funding, generally, though, in a government to government sort of way, and that health program gets enacted through us.
Because Myanmar has got horrible social and medical problems, hasn't it? It's the second in the world, worst in the world in malaria, isn't it? It's got very high HIV rate, TB. You're looking at all those things as well as psychological and social issues.
We are. Look, there's a lot of wonderful things about Burma, given we're talking about the
why you're there
straight away, you know, they're obviously the reasons we're there is that the health statistics, the economic statistics, you know, the average income is only around a dollar a day, the average income for the country, you know, and it's a very, very poor country of extremes, as many are with wealth, but of course most people are extremely poor. Health statistics are very problematic. Three priority diseases are TB, HIV, and malaria, as you mentioned. And so that's how we got involved. We have a sort of specialist in the public health area of HIV prevention initially, and so we're invited into the country to try to build the capacity of local community groups, civil society in general, right throughout the country, to prevent the transmission of HIV, or to care and treat people with HIV, and so that's how we got involved and built that up to a staff of 30 or so people, and then along came Cyclone Nargis, as if the people of Burma didn't need another problem. And I think Australians do have a fair sense of the scale of Cyclone Nargis, but but it was an unbelievably large human catastrophe. You know, even the official figures of 150,000 dead, you know, in a populated area where millions and millions were affected.
And there's no reason to trust the official figures on the number of dead any more than we trust any other official figures from the regime about anything.
For various reasons. I mean, I think estimating the number of dead would have been an extremely hard job anyway in that environment. But look, it's fair to say that they could have been much larger than that. It was an extraordinarily large catastrophe. That was 2 years ago. And so the Australian government supported the Burnett to have a much wider role in Burma at that time in the area of sort of humanitarian aid in a sense, not in emergency sense, but in helping build communities, doing the sort of work we do in HIV, but in a much broader scale.
So like that, preventative health across the board.
More in strengthening local community groups, civil society groups be able to, you know, to improve the health right across the spectrum of health activities that you need, you know, and we're
Kind of a very broad remit, isn't it?
But at the same time, it's contrary to everything a military dictatorship stands for. I mean, what you're doing is also building up the very sorts of things that would threaten their grip on power.
Well, I think that that's exactly right. You could interpret it that way. And my impression, I guess I'd personally built up a lot of negative impression about what would be possible in Burma. And yet here we were in a very official program with Myanmar government, at least knowledge and if not direct support, that is about building up sustainable programs in that country to improve health and now through this local resource centre that we've developed, education as well. That is one way of looking at it. You know, they are working, at least some programs are working like ours toward a much stronger, healthier, more better educated society.
You've got a very interesting mix, really, because, you know, Melbourne's so famous for the wonderful medical research institutions that we have, and but you've got a slight twist, haven't you, because you were sort of founded for public health and international health with some research, but then you merged with a very good research centre, the Austin Research Centre. But you have more of that... you know, the community and social development than many others have.
Yeah, we do. Look, we're a very unusual medical research institute. We, in one sense, we're a traditional medical research institute. We're from the beginnings when Ian Gust, as a virologist in the Fairfield
famous.
Hospital, started the institute
as a
fairly traditional medical research institute. Out of that grew very strong programs in virology.
Which is the study of viruses and, you know, all those basic ways in which our body sort of brokers them.
That's right. Yeah. And then public health work, international health work in particular, got started. And that is what's really grown. We have more than 200 staff, 140 live overseas now in various countries.
Wow, that's exciting, isn't it?
So it's a really growing program.
And you're looking at the
program.
Research into the basis of those diseases as well as the social conditions and
that's
that
right.
spread
so
them.
That's the common link between the institute, you know, from discovery-orientated research to research in the field to actually public health implementation of new policies, of new ways of preventing or treating diseases.
Because I know that you're quite well known for some of your work in injecting drugs and harm minimisation and all those big programs which, you know, are very much to do with health behaviours rather than the germs that cause the problem, which is it's a really interesting and unique approach.
Well, it's hard to do one and not the other, you know, injecting drug use. Big mode of transmission of HIV in Myanmar, for example, and of hepatitis C in this country. And so we work on those. But, of course, the drug dependency itself is a big problem, and so we don't tend to separate those things, the principles of harm reduction or different ways of improving the health of those communities are what's important to the Burnett in a comprehensive way.
Mm.
So what did you find when you got there? What's it like?
Well, it's a... My first impression is that it's an incredibly beautiful country. Now, I only went to three of the provinces. There's 50 million people in Burma, but it's an enormous country. And so it had the impression to me of being much less busy and crowded than I thought it would be, at least in those places. I guess I'd built up a sense of it being difficult to do anything. You know, there's that my mobile phone doesn't work, nor does anybody's. Within the country, you can get phone access, but not outside. Internet's terrible. So I'd built up this impression of nothing functioning. But the country does work. In at least in the cities that I went to, people, of course, get about their daily life, and they're very concerned about improving that. And that was a really lasting impression, along with the talent and the capability of the local Myanmar people, not just the ones that work for us, which I knew some of, but I was still astounded by the level of talent that's there. But clearly that's a question, well, it's a question I ask lots of people, and that's a commonly held view that the talent base is there. Education, at least in the major cities, has reached a level where people have capacity.
So the education obviously is publicly funded. How available is it across the country?
Well, there's really two major streams of education. One is the government system and the other is the monastic system, our Catholic education system. In fact, one of Burnett's major partners is a monastic school, which is involved in health promotion as well as, you know, education and in fact, of clinical work itself and teacher training, really remarkable places. So there's these parallel programs that go on, and there's tremendous scope for working, especially through the monastic system, to do more.
Mm. Can I cut across to something that's more sort of medical? Because one of the things you're best known for is malaria. That was your original starting place yourself, wasn't it? Malaria research.
It is indeed, and I'm still a malaria researcher. And you know,
you've had a big finding lately, haven't you, that might lead to a vaccine?
We have more for drugs, actually.
Oh, for a drug, for treatment,
yeah,
to stop it from replicating once it's in.
Yeah,
is that right?
Exactly. I think a lot of listeners would be astounded, really, to think of malaria as still, you know, the world's largest, close enough to the world's largest health problem.
Well, it's one of the major killers around the world, isn't it? 400 million people? No, it's 100 million a year who die, is that right?
No, 400 million people get sick every year from malaria, and about a million die. But the impact, the social, economic, you know, impact, it's not uncommon for people to spend half of their income on treating or preventing malaria, you know, and of course poor people can't afford to do that. Mm. So one of the tools, we obviously need a malaria vaccine, that's the holy grail, we don't have one, but what we do continually need is new drugs. And so that's what my group works on. We're interested in a vaccine. It still seems a little bit of a way off. But drugs, new therapies, you know, we had chloroquine. It doesn't work anymore.
Mm. Quinine, wasn't it?
That's another form of chloroquine. There are a whole class of drugs in that that are quinine derivatives, of which chloroquine is one. And resistance is pretty widespread to those. There's other drugs for which resistance is widespread. We're now really on a last line. It's a Chinese herbal drug called artemisinin and its derivatives. So most effective malarial treatments at the moment have artemisinin as one of the components. Along the Thailand border, there's now artemisinin resistance emerging.
So that'll spread pretty quickly.
Yeah, indeed. So we work at a very basic level trying to understand how the parasite grows and what are the unique things that it does that the human cells don't do, because that's how you make a drug, something that specifically targets the, in this case, parasite and not... doesn't interfere with, you know, it's non-toxic for us. And we made a big discovery last year of a way in which the parasite pumps proteins out of itself in a completely unique way. It's an essential process for a parasite, not shared by human host, and so you can make drugs to it.
So you might be able to intervene at the stage where the parasite is about to invade our red blood cells. It's at that stage, isn't it?
It's actually just after that. Uh-huh. The parasite inside a red blood cell.
Right.
It renovates it, like renovating a home, and it does it for a number of reasons. But one of the reasons it wants to do it is the red cell that's now infected with a parasite does not want to stay in the circulation. If it stays in the circulation, it's going to go through the spleen. That's a very bad thing. So it wants to become sticky and stick to the walls of your blood vessels. And so that's really
what the parasite makes the red blood cell do,
that's
so
exactly
therefore
right.
It doesn't get destroyed in the spleen.
That's right. Mm-hmm. To make it sticky, it has to really make a lot of changes to the red cell. And our discovery is really about how that happens and how to interfere with that process.
That's great, because it was in Nature magazine, wasn't it? One of the most prestigious. Yeah, well, that's fantastic.
Well, there's a lot of attention on malaria because,
it's still coming to Australia, really big too, thing. Isn't it? Is climate change going to impact malaria here? It's going with dengue, it's coming down, isn't it, already?
The mosquitoes are here. There's probably still not enough population in our north. You know, enough humans and enough mosquitoes. And we're probably in the tropical north.
Mosquitoes.
There needs to be a certain time.
They all bite me.
I was
I was told that if you overdose on, I think is it vitamin C, for 2 weeks before you go to a malaria zone, you keep taking the vitamin supplements, the mosquitoes don't like the taste of it and they don't bite you.
Well, you know, if you overdose on vitamin C, you're in trouble.
Well, not overdose.
As much trouble as malaria.
Overdose. I mean, but basically taking one of those fizzy drinks pretty much, you know, twice a day, and that would increase the level of the vitamin in you, and then the mosquitoes don't like the taste of it and they leave you alone.
Look, there's a lot of potential sort of wives' tale-y solutions to that.
Folk remedies.
Well, we did it, and I didn't get malaria, so therefore it works.
So exactly
absolutely.
Right.
We're loving that kind of evidence base.
If the drink you took it with was tonic water, and you took tons of that, then maybe
I like tonic water anyway. But no, it's one of those recovery drink things. So, you know, that was the theory, and I don't know. Someone should be checking out whether there's anything to it or not, I suppose.
Probably does need to be checked out. But there's more reliable, scientifically proven ways to not get bitten.
Like wearing long sleeve shirts and not wearing shorts.
And wearing repellents and using insecticide, you know, treated
bed nets. And mosquito nets and all of those sort of
precautionary
things.
And what about that theory around about lemons and AIDS and HIV? Was there some sort of theory about... do you know about that? That lemon was supposed to somehow protect women vaginally from HIV infection. Is that true?
Well, you know, it's theoretically true. The acid in lemon could potentially, it's actually quite fragile virus. But once again, I wouldn't be advocating any of those therapies.
Text message, it's vitamin B, not C, and it works. So there you are.
Ah, well, we'll just accept that.
Yes, it's scientifically proven.
That saved a lot of money in research.
In fact, it has to be vitamin B because, in fact, when I think about it, the title of the particular additive starts with B because of exactly that, but I'm not advertising it. And I'm told whiskey works very well too, by text message.
Whiskey works remarkably well for many things.
That's right, particularly in Burma.
Yes, when I was working in a bottle shop as a student, it was always medicinal brandy that we sold. It was never any other reason why people were buying it. Brendan, look, thank you very much for telling us about your work and the Burnet Institute's work around the world, but particularly with your visit just now to Burma, a country that enjoys a troubled, checkered human rights record, and where the people are engaged in what would seem to be a ceaseless and endless struggle against a military regime, which does, though, care enough about the health of its people to allow the Burnet Institute to do some work there. Professor Brendan Crabb, Director and CEO of the Burnet Institute, who has literally just got back. Gail Jennings, my co-host, Brendan Crabb, our first guest, and Anita Heiss joining us next as an author of a new, I think it's chick lit. She bridges both worlds. She tries to write books that make you laugh whilst at the same time doing serious research as well. Anita Heiss, our next guest on The Conversation Hour.
1774 ABC Melbourne.
Gail Jennings from Great Connections is my co-host. Brendan Crabb from the Burnet Institute's our first guest, and we're now joined by Anita Heiss. She's an adjunct associate professor at the University of Western Sydney, but she also writes Indigenous chick lit, if such a category exists. I'm not sure that it ever did before until Anita invented it. Her new book is called Manhattan Dreaming, and it's about an art gallery curator who's involved in Aboriginal art who goes to New York, well, on fellowship, and all the extraordinary things that might happen when you put those unlikely combinations together. Congratulations, Anita. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's all a bit of fun. Did you just manage to tax-deduct a trip to New York in the name of research for this?
Well, I did, but I need to say it wasn't all a bit of fun.
Congratulations.
And then can I just say that it's interesting, you mentioned that the Indigenous chicklet thing. This is my third book in the so-called created genre, but I didn't actually know I was writing chicklet per se. I was just, the first one was purging myself of 15 years of bad dates, actually, and trying to put Indigenous women into literature in terms of a contemporary urban setting. But I prefer to call it contemporary women's fiction, and then it moves up the literary hierarchy somewhat.
It's all about the branding, isn't it?
Well, the reality is, I mean, I never read in this genre. As I said, I didn't know. I was just writing stories for a purpose. I wanted to write, you know, I read commercial fiction. There's no reason why we shouldn't write commercial fiction. I'd had discussions with publishers who would say to me, oh, your work's not really Aboriginal because it's not about land rights or native title and so forth. I was like, well, hang on. Well, yes, we do have those conversations all the time and we march and so forth, but we have relationships. We fall in love.
No, you don't.
We fall out. Well, some people do. I don't. We fall in love. We fall out of love. I'm told people still make love. That common experience of relationships and the fear of rejection and what we feel emotionally as human beings has got nothing to do with cultural heritage. It's got nothing to do with socioeconomics or geography, whether you're in Melbourne or Manuka or Manhattan or so forth. So I wanted to make the point that we are very similar in terms of human beings, but that there is a complexity in terms of interracial relationships, that women like myself who were born in I was born in Sydney, born and bred in Gadigal country. I've lived on Dharawal land out near La Perouse all my life. All my contemporaries are people like Larissa Berendt, who's a fabulous lawyer and an author, Terry Janke, IP lawyer, Robin Quiggin, lawyer. We all live in Sydney. We don't exist on that radar in terms of literature, in terms of what you see in the media generally, outside of the ABC, I mean, of course. But so I wanted to write us onto the radar as well. And I wanted Australian women who bind this genre. Marketing departments will tell you that 18 to 45-year-old women buy this book. They might walk into Borders tonight at 6 p.m. while I'm there signing. Or so forth. I've never heard of Anita Heiss. Maybe never read a book by a black fella before. May not even have an interest in reading a book by a black fella. But they will look for a book that looks like the book they just read, which in these sort of covers all very similar, pastel, skinny waist and so forth. And the thing is, this book's selling, all my books have sold really, really well. And I now have people, journos and women all around the country emailing me or interviewing me and so forth, saying that they've Googled the artists that I mention in these books, the musicians, the playwrights and so forth, because I use real Indigenous artists, particularly in Manhattan Dreaming, to drive the story about urban identity and so forth and the sort of things we do. I mean, the novel begins at the National Aboriginal Gallery in Canberra, which is housed in the old Parliament House. And I've moved the tent embassy into the old country party rooms. So there's politics in there in a very accessible way that your average Aussie may not actually participate in that discussion at any other time.
So this was a conscious decision then to Trojan horse normality.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think we've seen it done in some ways very well when we had a character in The Secret Life of Us with Deb Marlin who was just a woman sharing a house. But the reality is, I mean, I write through a lens of being an Aboriginal woman. I've known I was a black fella since the kids at school called me Abbo Boong Coon Chocolate Drop and Cocoa Pop at a Catholic school I went to.
Altogether?
In the 70s. Yeah, it was a long sentence.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, you know, white fellas make black fellas. We just make babies. You know, we make babies and then we're told you this, you this, you this, you're half caste, quarter caste, quadroon and so forth. So I wanted to write about, through my lens of living like that. My mother was born on a Rambi mission in Cowra. My great-grandmother was Minnie Tompkins. She was born on a Rambi. She had my grandmother who was born in Brungle and was under the Act of Protection was removed to Coonamundra Girls' Home. And so in my lifetime, I'm incredibly privileged in an Indigenous context, absolutely privileged. But I've basically just had the human rights that any child born anywhere around the world should have, access to health, and education and housing. And I guess part of this is about saying we had a civil rights movement in this country. We're still going through it in terms of legislation that's racist in this country and an ongoing cultural genocide. But the whole point of having a civil rights movement was to say that we could live in a similar way as other Australians. And so one of the reasons I write these kind of books is I want to also encourage blackfellas to read.
But there's nothing particularly astonishing that there's an emerging Aboriginal middle class. I mean, I think we got used to that a while ago.
Well, John, there's not a lot of discussion about it at all. It mightn't be astonishing, but it's not actually discussed. It's not really, it's not written in our literature and so forth. It's not talked about a lot amongst ourselves, to be honest with you. And part of this is about saying, I'm also an Indigenous Literacy Day ambassador, so I'm painfully aware every day when I go into communities and do books in homes and so forth, that in, for instance, in the Northern Territory, only 1 in 5 kids in remote communities are reading at an acceptable level.
Oh, and there's whole communities, you know, where English is a foreign language, well, and nothing's conducted in English.
Second, third and fourth languages, yeah. You know, we have 1/3 of Indigenous young people at the age of 15 are reading at a below acceptable level. So I want to write books that actually encourage Aboriginal people to read, because it's not rocket science. Brown kids want to see brown kids on the page. You know,
it's also such a clever a strategy as well, though, because you know, it's people aren't threatened by reading a gentle and funny book, and things are normative then. You know, they think, oh, yeah, well, that's interesting. Oh, my God, as you say, look up that artist or whatever. It's not confrontational. And even though there's all the reasons in the world to be confrontational, this is such a clever way to enter into people's lives where, therefore, it's not going to be as much conflict. Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Though, in terms of emerging Indigenous middle class, is it true that there is an emerging Indigenous middle class? Are things, in fact, getting better at that rate?
I don't think you should look at Anita Heiss and think that Indigenous Australia is getting better at all. I think when I travel, I do a lot of lecturing in the US and even around Australia, and I ask the audiences to think about the top 1% of the country in which they live and what sort of power do they have, where do they live, what sort of money do they make, what sort of jobs do they have and so forth. And they're rattling off, you know, politicians and media moguls and so forth. And I'm like, well, I'm probably in the top 1% of the bottom 2.5% of our nation, and that's just because I have a job and I have a car, I have a roof over my head, and I'm educated. So in the white world, I'm not necessarily extraordinary, but in my community, I'm absolutely privileged, which is why I do what I do also, because there's an expectation I put on myself and at the community level that I use the position, I use an opportunity to be on John Fain or wherever else I'm speaking today to say, this is the reality about literacy in Australia. We're talking about closing the gap on a whole lot of levels, but we will never have self-determination in this country if we're not self-determined as individuals. And you need to be literate to have a form of self-determination, because what we have is huge numbers of Aboriginal people relying on white fellas to make decisions for them in key areas of their lives simply because they can't read basic everyday needs, you know, street signs and so forth. So I'm really, as I mentioned, I'm part of the Indigenous Literacy Project, which is based on goodwill through authors, the Australian booksellers,
put a lot
and
of
publishers, the Australian Society of Authors, and a lot of individuals who last year we raised $377,000 and put 15,000 books into 160 communities. Mm-hmm. Anita Heiss, Ambassador Cap Off, thinks that it's appalling that we have to fundraise to teach Australian children to read, to get adequate resources into communities in the Northern Territory and also South Australia, Western New South Wales, and so forth, when that bucket of money is not a huge amount of money in the big scheme of things. But we do it because booksellers and publishers recognise that their whole industries are based on people being able to read. Mm.
I don't know if you saw it on the weekend. It was in ABC News Online. I was having a look, and Glenn Dooley, who's this principal lawyer, used to be in Darwin at the Aboriginal Legal Service in Darwin, but it's got a new name and I can't remember what they've retitled it. But he's a very experienced bloke, and Glenn Dooley said that the biggest problem at the moment is that there are young Aboriginal offenders who prefer to be in jail than in their communities, because the communities are so dysfunctional. When they offend, they actually say, I'd rather go and get locked up. Now, Glenn wouldn't say that lightly.
Well, I can't comment on that.
He's saying that the interventions made things worse, not better in some ways, and that some of these communities now are so dysfunctional, prison's a better alternative. Where does that leave us?
Well, I've been into a number of communities for different hats that I wear, and I went to a community prior to the intervention, and I went to a community post the intervention, and so many people had left for a whole range of reasons that it was effectively dysfunctional, and it was born out of the intervention. I mean, there's a whole lot of issues around that in terms of the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act, which in itself demonstrates that it had to be. It's a race-based legislation and policy, therefore it's racist. I've worked with a lot of children in detention doing workshops, and I've met lots of Koori kids, particularly in New South Wales, who will say that and I don't necessarily think it's attached just to Aboriginal children, but that's where they have a sense of family. They get three meals a day and they have a bed. I think in relation to literacy, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, back in the 90s, one of the many recommendations which has not been acted upon, was ensuring that literacy was addressed in Indigenous communities, because a high proportion of those who are incarcerated are illiterate.
Mm, it's a cycle. Mm, and I know this is a bit of a long stretch, but I don't know that Burma, for instance, and dealing with entrenched poverty there, caused not by racist policies, but caused by military oppression, but breaking the cycle in Burma, in your experience, is it a similar approach that's needed, I suppose? Stretching it across to there, Brendan?
It's really hard to say. The education rate is extremely low, especially if you get into the poor areas. But I'm probably more encouraged about it than I thought I would be. You know, I went to a monastic school, as I mentioned earlier, and the class I went into was a preschool class in English. It was quite astonishing, and this sort of thing is, I mean, that was a really good example of what's happening. So I think that there's a great deal of attention, including from the government, but also non-government organisations in Burma, that education is the key to Burma pulling itself out of oppression. So there's at least that recognition, and I saw on a number of places I went to and people I spoke to that's well recognised and is happening.
Which leaves me with the inescapable conclusion that the military regime in Burma is doing a better job at dealing with some of its intergenerational issues than the Australian government is with our Indigenous communities and their intergenerational issues. Where does that leave us?
Well, it's a hard analysis to do in a defined way, but they were my impressions. And
What do you reckon, Anita?
Well, in a very simplistic...
The Burmese general's doing a better job than we are.
Well, I mean, a very simple answer to that would be that the reality is the bureaucrats that were advising the Howard government are probably the same bureaucrats that are advising this government. Mm. Governments change, but the administrations within, government departments stay the same. So.
And similarly at state level rather than just at federal level. Mm. It's a damning indictment. Look, we were going to talk more about your book, Manhattan Dreaming by Anita Heiss. Manhattan Dreaming, I think, is it the third one in the...
It's the third one in this genre, but it's one of two. The next one's set in Paris. But this is really about Lauren Lucas. I know, Lauren Lucas, who goes to work from the National Aboriginal Gallery in Canberra. She goes over to the Smithsonian to work at the National Museum of the American Indian, so we can put the international Indigenous connection on the radar as well. And again, she's very, very focused, career-driven, excellent, top of her field in terms of being a curator. But like many women, I'm not putting my hand up for this, but like many women who are quite capable and educated, she makes appalling choices in her personal life. And so the idea is to use the story of Indigenous arts and so forth to drive a story, but it's about relationships, essentially.
And it's a ripping good yarn. It's hilarious.
Manhattan Dreaming by Anita Heiss, published by Bantam, an imprint of Allen and Unwin. And our other guest, Brendan Crabb, is the director of the Burnett Institute. That's been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available every day. Log on to abc.net.au/Melbourne, click the podcast link and subscribe now. You'll never know who you'll end up with on your player. abc.net.au/Melbourne.